Shalom, and thank you for listening at BethEmmanuel.org. At Beth Emmanuel, we are proclaiming the vital gospel message of the coming kingdom of heaven. If you share our passion for this message, please support this teaching ministry and messianic community with your prayers and financial contributions. To learn how, click on the donate tab at BethEmmanuel.org.
This is a talk that I originally delivered at the UMJC National Conference in Boston, and then I also then delivered it at Beth Emmanuel for Parshat Ekev. But anyway, I'd like to read for you a passage out of the Passover Haggadah. And at the conference, I brought with me a classic. It's the Maxwell House Coffee Edition of the Haggadah from 1965. Well, the story of the Maxwell House Haggadah is interesting. And so at the end of my lecture, I'll tell you the story. But for right now, I have a lot to say. So here's the passage I'd like to read, and I apologize for the archaic language. They hadn't updated it yet in 1965. It says, Rabbi Elazar, the son of Azariah, said, "Verily, I am like a man of 70 years of age, yet I was not able to prove that the narration of the departure from Egypt should be made at night until the son of Zoma proved it from the following words of Scripture, that thou mayest remember the day of thy going forth from Egypt, all the days of thy life. The days of thy life," said he, "referred to the days alone, but all the days of thy life include the nights also. The doctors, however," meaning the sages, "say thus, the days of thy life refer to this world only, but all the days of thy life include the time of Messiah." Okay, well, this often overlooked passage from the Haggadah cites the second half of Deuteronomy 16:3. That's the verse that says, "that you may remember all the days of your life, the day when you came out of the land of Egypt." Now, the debate in the Haggadah is about what that word "all" comes to include. So according to Rabbi Elazar, it means not just the daytime part of the day, but also the nighttime. And according to the sages, it means the commandment applies not just to the current age, but also to the Messianic era. Okay, well, bear in mind that the Hebrew word translated "remember" doesn't just mean to recall mentally. It implies a verbal expression. It means to mention out loud. But why is this debate in the Passover Haggadah at all? I mean, the command to tell the story of the Exodus from Egypt on Passover night does not come from this verse. It comes from Exodus 13:8. It says, "You shall tell your son on that day, saying, it is because of what the Lord did for me when I came out of Egypt." So, but the verse from Deuteronomy gives us a command to mention the Exodus from Egypt every day of the year, and according to Rabbi Elazar, twice a day. Well, I'm not actually here to talk about the Haggadah. I'm here to talk about the Siddur, and specifically the patterns of redemption in the Siddur. Now, the Siddur is the Jewish prayer book. And it's, you got to understand, it's not just a collected assortment of prayers. It's like not like a hymnal that you pick and choose from like a la carte. It's more like a symphony that takes you through a process involving many steps toward a destination. And the Siddur is a guide not just to prayer, but really Jewish life altogether. It doesn't contain creeds, so to speak, but it is the closest thing that Judaism has to a theological manual. And it shapes the perspective of the reader, and it does this by contextualizing our experiences. You know, humans experience all kinds of events in life, but each person has a filter through which one processes these experiences. And the Siddur aims to guide us in forming a healthy filter. For example, the Siddur contains blessings that a person should say when experiencing natural phenomena. You know, a clap of thunder can be frightening, especially for children. But the Siddur tells us that if a person hears thunder, one should say, "Blessed are you, O Lord our God, King of the universe, whose strength and power fill the world." And so this blessing guides us not to see the thunderstorm as having power of itself apart from God. The blessing harnesses that moment of emotion we feel and directs it toward awe and recognition of our Creator. Now, the Siddur then shapes our thinking by contextualizing all our life experiences, including the experience of time and the passage of time itself. The Siddur is a symphony, and a symphony is not just a collection of tunes. It's a musical megastructure guided by the principles of music theory. In the same way, the Siddur is a megastructure with its own internal consistency and integrity, woven together with strands and fibers according to a set of principles and laws. So let me give you one example of a law of Siddur construction. A blessing in the familiar format that we all know, "Blessed are you, O Lord our God, King of the universe," is actually a royal invocation of God's name that must follow certain protocols. So some brachot, like the bracha for thunder, are just a single line. But others can be a longer paragraph, one that brings in lots of topical threads. And if so, then the paragraph will end with a conclusion. And that conclusion is called a hatima. And it's a sentence in the format, "Blessed are you, O Lord." Well, there is a protocol in Jewish law that says no matter what direction the paragraph goes, no matter what ideas it brings in, the sentence that comes immediately prior to that concluding line, prior to the Chatima, must express the basic essence of the blessing. So if you want to understand the point of any long bracha, you have to examine the sentence that comes just before the line, "Blessed are you, O Lord." And that rule is called Me'ein Chatima Samuch L'Chatima. Well, the fact that the Siddur is held together by numerous technical principles like this gives me pause when it comes to developing messianic innovations in liturgy. I've been working for many years on crafting a messianic Siddur, and I'm not the first person by a long shot to embark on such a project, but I'm honestly glad that it has taken me so long, because over the years I've come to realize how much I have yet to learn about what went into the architecture and art of this book. And the more I've studied and learned and processed, the more I've realized that developing a messianic Siddur is like making lemon-flavored lemonade. You know, lemonade is already lemon-flavored, and a Siddur is already messianic by nature. And this, that's because the Siddur guides us to cry out to God in unity to bring the solution to our collective troubles. And it also guides us in comprehending and visualizing what that solution looks like. So from the perspective of Orthodox and historical Judaism, that solution is the coming of the Messiah and the final redemption. The Siddur wants us to know this and to seek this redemption, and thus the Siddur, by its very nature, is then messianic. And that's not to say a messianic Siddur isn't needed. I mean, we, as messianic Jews who follow Yeshua and know him to be the Messiah, want to invoke his name. But if we don't understand and tap into the natural messianic energy that already exists in the Siddur, then we're likely to derail it by cutting and pasting in messianic passages with only superficial connections. And we will end up with a liturgy that feels disjointed and unnatural and forced. But if we take the time to really appreciate what the Siddur wants to teach about redemption, well, we can leverage that to integrate our devotion to Yeshua the Messiah and arrive at something both powerful and indigenous to Judaism. The Siddur contains many individual prayers and phrases that mention Messiah, but I want to zoom out and look at how the larger patterns point to the Messiah. And I have many such patterns in mind, but I have to select one or else this will be a seminar and not just a lecture. But in order for me to show you such a pattern, I need to give you a crash course in Jewish prayer, in case you're not familiar. So in Judaism, daily prayer is an obligation on every single human being, and because prayer is engaging in relationship with God, which is the reason humans were created. Every moment you spend in prayer is a moment you are fulfilling your purpose for existence. Judaism teaches that prayer can happen in any language, in any place, and any time of the day. But there is another dimension to prayer in Judaism, and that is service. Have you ever wondered why Christians and Jews both refer to a prayer meeting as a service? It's because it's connected to the service of the Kohanim, the priests, offering sacrifices in the temple. The Torah refers to their daily offerings as service, as avodah. And the rabbis called prayer the service of the heart, as opposed to the service of the altar. That within each one of us there is a temple, and there is no one else but you who can perform its rituals. Jewish prayer follows the rhythm of the Torah's prescribed sacrifices. Initially, it accompanied them, and now, in the absence of the temple, it stands alone. Well, Numbers 28 prescribes the rhythm of the daily burnt offerings, the Korban Tamid. One lamb was offered every morning and one every afternoon, and all the other sacrifices were sandwiched in between those two, apart from the Korban Pesach, which is the Passover lamb. So the first thing to notice is that Jewish prayer services, like the sacrifices, happen every day, not just on a weekly day of worship. So if you live in a large enough Jewish community, you can join a minyan, a congregation, every day. And if not, well, you're still responsible for performing this duty on your own. Secondly, there are three times of prayer each day: evening, morning, and afternoon. So that's Ma'ariv, Shacharit, and Mincha. And the morning and afternoon prayers, that's Shacharit and Mincha, correspond to the morning and afternoon burnt offering. And then the evening prayer, Ma'ariv, corresponds to the overnight smoldering of the leftovers on the altar, which is a sacred duty prescribed in Leviticus 6. Well, those three times of prayer sweep across the globe like waves as the earth turns on its axis. And the two core components form the main structure of these three prayer times, and everything else is either preparatory or auxiliary. So these two components are the Shema and the Amidah. Now, the Shema is actually only recited at evening and morning, at Ma'ariv and Shacharit. The Shema consists of not only the famous line, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one," but that full paragraph in Deuteronomy 6, and then another paragraph from Deuteronomy 11, and a third paragraph from Numbers 15. Now, these three readings from the Torah are buttressed by three blessings as well, two beforehand and one afterward. So the three biblical paragraphs plus the blessings before and after form, in total, the structural component known as the recitation of the Shema. The other component is called the Amidah, or Shmoneh Esrei, and it's a sequence of 19 short blessings. And the first three are praise, the 13 in the middle are petitions, and the last three are thanks. Now, on Shabbat, the 13 petitions in the middle are replaced with one blessing that's just about Shabbat, so then the prayer only has seven blessings. Now, the Amidah is recited at all three times of prayer, and that's because it's meant to correspond to those sacrificial services. The Shema, however, is actually not directly related to the sacrifices. The reason we recite the Shema twice a day, evening and morning, is because of the text itself. It says, You shall teach them diligently to your sons, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise up. So now the second paragraph from Deuteronomy 11 contains nearly identical language. To the sages, when you lie down and when you rise up are not literal, but they refer to times of day, evening and morning. So since we're already praying the Amidah evening and morning based on the sacrifices, we just include these biblical passages. Well, we have two interesting questions to ask as we look at the structure. First of all, why didn't they interpret it literally as, you know, the moment of going to bed and waking up? And secondly, what about that third paragraph from Numbers that does not include this phrasing, but it really just seems to be mostly about wearing tzitzis? Now, the blessings that come before and after these scriptural paragraphs also follow a pattern. The first one is about God as the creator of the universe. The second blessing is about the covenant at Mount Sinai, the love relationship between God and Israel, which is expressed through the study and the observance of the commandments. Now, the blessing afterward is about God as Redeemer, and especially the Exodus from Egypt. So both the evening and morning blessings follow this pattern: creator, covenant, and then redemption. But other than that, there are notable differences between the two. As I described before, the purpose of these blessings is to contextualize our experience of reciting the Shema, and to shape the filters through which we perceive the world. So we can learn a lot about Jewish thought and theology by analyzing the wording of these blessings. So let's take a look at some of those differences between how those blessings read in the nighttime version and in the daytime version. In the evening, the first blessing, the one for creation, is fairly brief. It emphasizes that God is the one who brought on the darkness. In fact, the word ma'ariv comes from this blessing and means he brings darkness. You know, you remember that rule I cited before called me'ein chatima samuch l'chatima. That's the essence of a bracha must be stated immediately prior to the closing line. So what is the me'ein chatima of this blessing? It's the sentence, may the living and enduring God continuously reign over us for all eternity. Strange. What does that prayer have to do with evening? It just says that God is living and enduring, and his kingship over us is continual. It's something to ponder. Well, the creation blessing in the morning Shema is quite different and much longer. It opens by telling us that he makes peace, that he illuminates the earth with compassion. He created bright luminaries that shine on his works, demonstrating his glory. And then the blessing goes a step further, inviting us to participate in an apocalyptic vision. The Siddur brings us up into the heavenly realms where we see angels surrounding his throne, like the visions of Isaiah or Ezekiel or John, where the angels cry out, holy, holy, holy. And finally, what's the Me'ein Chatima that appears just before the closing line of this morning version? It says, may you shine a new light on Zion, and may we all speedily merit its light. So it's looking forward to something in the future. Now let's look at blessing two, which is that blessing about the love relationship between God and Israel expressed through the covenant of Torah. In the evening, once again, the blessing is brief. In it, we promise to study and meditate on the Torah day and night when we lie down and when we rise up, for they are our life and the length of our days. And the Me'ein Chatima is honestly a bit foreboding. It says, may you not remove your love from us forever. Well, let's contrast that with the one for the morning. Here, we ask God to show us grace and compassion and grant us divine assistance to understand and observe the Torah. We ask God to fulfill his covenant by breaking the yoke from our necks and gathering us from the four corners of the earth into the land of Israel. And the Me'ein Chatima is beautiful. It says, "And you, our King, have brought us close to your great name forever in truth, in love, to offer praiseful thanks to you and to proclaim your oneness with love and to love your name." Okay, so that's the difference between the second blessing in the evening and the morning. Now let's consider the third blessing. In the evening, we emphasize God's faithfulness. He exacts vengeance on our enemies, as he did to Pharaoh, striking his firstborn dead. The Israelites at the sea willingly accepted God's kingship over themselves. And then the Me'ein Chatima is, "For Hashem has redeemed Jacob and delivered him from a power mightier than he." Now, the morning blessing, quite notably, repeats the word emet, emet, true, over and over again. It presents God's truth as a beloved and an unmistakable fact, and it spans history and expresses thanks for all the many salvations of the past. And it emphasizes God taking his people out of slavery and bondage in fulfillment of his promises. And it describes the joy with which the Israelites sang the song at the sea, calling it a new song. The Me'ein Chatima is, "Rock of Israel, arise to the aid of Israel and liberate, as you pledged, Judah and Israel. As it is said, our Redeemer, Hashem, Master of Legions is his name, is the Holy One of Israel." So through this pattern of blessings, the Siddur is not just training us to understand the Shema, but it's actually teaching us how to interpret the passage of time itself, especially the cycle of night and day. Now, in order to really understand the Siddur's message here, I have to give you another crash course, and this time in Jewish eschatology. Eschatology is a big word, but it just means the study of the end times. And a foundational concept in Jewish eschatology is the dichotomy between exile and redemption, between galut and geula. Now, if you already know the words exile and redemption from another context, just set that aside, because these words have a specialized meaning in the context of Jewish eschatology. And there are many examples of this dichotomy that I could cite from the Tanakh, but a very clear and concise example is found in the second paragraph of the Shema in Deuteronomy 11. And here it says, "It shall come about, if you listen obediently to my commandments, which I'm commanding you today, to love the Lord your God and to serve him with all your heart and all your soul, that he will give the rain for your land in its season, the early and late rain, that you may gather in your grain and your new wine and your oil. He will give grass in your fields for your cattle, and you will eat and be satisfied." So according to this passage, keeping the covenant means Israel's rootedness in the land, the openness of the heavens, peace, security, satisfaction. And this encapsulates the concept of redemption, of geula. But if you turn away, it says, "The anger of the Lord will be kindled against you, and he will shut up the heavens so that there will be no rain, and the ground will not yield its fruit, and you will perish quickly from the good land which the Lord is giving you." So according to this warning, when the heavens are closed and the land itself rejects you, resulting in a loss of sovereignty and security and peace, God forbid, well, this describes the experience of exile. And a prime example of this occurred with the Babylonian exile. King Nebuchadnezzar came and deported the citizens of Judah to Babylon, and prophets such as Jeremiah teach us that this exile occurred as a result of Israel's lack of covenant fidelity. So exile means detachment from the land, but it's really not all or nothing. It's more like a pendulum that has been swinging back and forth throughout Jewish history. We have times of more connectedness to the land, more connectedness to God, more openness of the heavens, more revelation of God. And then there are times when things are, you know, not going so well. We lack sovereignty over the land. We lack peace, we lack connection, and we lack residency within the land. Well, this back and forth transition between exile and redemption is depicted clearly for us in the first chapter of Matthew, in the genealogy of Yeshua. And this chapter divides the generations of the kings of Israel into three groups of 14. From Abraham to David, that's the peak of Israel's connection to the land, 14 generations. And from David to the Babylonian exile, 14 generations. And then from the darkness of the Babylonian exile to the birth of Yeshua the Messiah, 14 generations. And so from light to darkness and back to light again. Well, the number 14 alludes to the waxing and waning of the moon, which each take place over 14-day periods. And the Siddur as well uses the lunar phases as a symbol for Israel's fluctuation between exile and redemption, between detachment and connection to the land. The experience of Israel over history, encapsulated in the genealogy of her kings, is just a constant cycle of back and forth between these two states. And this history of the kings of Israel and Judah is the spinal cord of the Tanakh. And you have to understand this history in order to make any sense of the prophets, because the prophets urged Israel to covenant faithfulness, warned them of the consequences of failure, and consoled them about Israel's eventual return from exile. Well, it's in this context, in the context of the good news of about the return from exile, that all of the most overt prophecies, the messianic prophecies, occur. So when you hear in Jeremiah or Isaiah or Ezekiel about the Messiah, these prophets are talking about him in the context of the return from exile. And this teaches us that the coming of Messiah is ultimately a swing of the pendulum into redemption, but one that finally takes us all the way there and will never go back. It's going to be like previous redemptions, but more so, and it will be permanent. And the prophets compare this ultimate redemption to the exodus from Egypt. So Egypt is thus the prototype of all exiles, and the exodus is the prototype of all redemptions, especially the messianic redemption. Okay, so now that you understand exile and redemption, a second important concept in Jewish eschatology is the cosmic timeline. So in the historic Jewish view, human existence is divided into three eras. And it begins with this current world, or this current age, which is called Olam Hazeh. And it ends with the future world, the age to come, or Olam Haba. And now these two terms appear several times in the New Testament, and in between these two periods, there is a transitional period known as the Days of Messiah, or the Messianic Era. It's the Kingdom of Heaven. Many prophetic promises God made to the patriarchs and to Israel have still not come to pass. The Messianic Era is when we will see all those promises fulfilled, literally and completely. A kingdom will be established. Yeshua, the Messiah, will literally sit on his throne in Jerusalem. Israel will be gathered from the four corners of the earth, and even the righteous dead will be raised so that their own eyes can see these promises coming true. And, according to many traditional sources, this kingdom will last 1,000 years, and it's like the universe experiences Shabbat at the end of a long week. Well, after that, we move into Olam Haba, and that's the world to come. It's a time that's beyond our ability, beyond our capacity to understand or describe. And it's a time of bliss. It's a time of connection with God like never before, and it lasts for all eternity. Well, that's that's all that's just standard historic Jewish eschatology. It's not something I made up. It's just the normal view of Jewish end times. And it helps us to understand our questions about the Shema. Because night and day is an experience that we all share. Every 24 hours at night, the darkness means that we feel, you know, vulnerable, anxious, insecure. We can't see what's ahead of us. The morning comes and everything's different. You know, the path becomes clear. The invisible becomes visible, and we feel secure and at peace, and we can see we're not alone. The Siddur guides us through that experience of night and day to tell us that this is a microcosm of history, of exile and redemption. So at Ma'ariv, the Siddur guides us to pray from the perspective of exile, even when the temple was standing. At night, its doors were closed. And so instead of a sacrifice, there was only the smoldering remains of what once was. So it really well describes our current experience. Shacharit guides us to pray from the perspective of redemption, teaching us to utilize the comfort and the security we feel to envision a permanent change to the world's existence. Now, the reason we say the Shema twice a day is, well, simply because of the wording. It says, when you lie down and when you arise. Now, that's not just talking about our physical posture. Lying down is that feeling of sinking, of degradation, of death. Rising up is our regaining yourself. It's putting on your strength. It's resurrection. And whether we feel like we're falling or rising, either collectively as a nation or personally in our lives, the Siddur wants us to remember one thing, and that is that God is one. And so the darkness is not an external force that somehow slipped through God's defenses. Hashem is in complete control and of both situations, light and darkness, exile and redemption. Okay, so all this helps us understand the first two paragraphs of the Shema, which both use the words, when you lie down and when you arise, but still leaves us hanging with the third paragraph. Remember that verse that we started with from the Haggadah? The verse that we started from the Haggadah is Deuteronomy 16:3. It says that you may remember all the days of your life, the day when you came out of the land of Egypt. Now, it's a commandment in the Torah. It's a biblical commandment in the Torah to remember, which means to mention the day when you came out from the land of Egypt, the exodus from Egypt, every single day. It's a commandment to mention it. And according to Rabbi Elazar ben Azaria, that's twice a day, both by night and by day. And although the third paragraph talks about tzitzit, it was actually chosen because of its concluding line in Numbers 15:41. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt to be your God. I am the Lord your God. So by saying that sentence, each time we say the Shema, we fulfill our obligation to mention the Exodus from Egypt by night and by day. But why? Why twice a day? I mean, why wouldn't it be enough just to mention Exodus from Egypt once a day? And also, why is this brought up in the Seder, in the Passover Haggadah, when Passover is just like a once a year event? Well, it's because of the dual nature of what the Passover lamb represents and what the Haggadah wants to show us about that. On one hand, the Passover lamb that our fathers had at their seders every year, it symbolizes how God destroyed the firstborn of Egypt, back in Egypt, but passed over the doors of our ancestors when he saw the blood on our doorposts. And when did that happen? What time? It was at midnight. But the Passover lamb also symbolizes that God brought us out from Egypt. So the physical departure of the Israelites from Egypt did not take place until morning. So when did the Israelites actually become free people? Well, there was a redemption that happened at night, and there was a redemption that happened by day. At midnight, even though they remained in Egypt, they were no longer slaves. Their status had changed. Their ownership had changed. They were free, even as they remained in the midst of a place of impurity and a time of darkness. But then came the second redemption, when we physically came out from Egypt at the rising of the sun. Not just a spiritual transfer, but a geographic transition from a kingdom of darkness to a kingdom of light. Now, the sages have a saying, as was the redemption from Egypt, so will be the messianic redemption. And we can learn from this that just as there were two kinds of redemption from Egypt, by night and by day, there are also two aspects of freedom from exile that are to take place through the hand of Messiah. And really, it's not hard from a messianic Jewish perspective to see how these two redemptions will take place through our Messiah, Yeshua, who came already once in the midst of darkness and will come again on the clouds of heaven. Well, we could spend our lives going to bed, waking up, feeling vulnerable, feeling secure, you know, and never realize what it's all about. And the Siddur is training us to see the bigger picture. The sun is setting tonight, but one day it will rise and it will never set again. So this pattern, the two recitations of the Shema, it's just one of many examples of messianic superstructures in the Siddur. The Siddur is just naturally messianic, just like lemon in lemonade. And, you know, if we engage in it, if we embrace it, and we allow it to shape our perception of the world, well, then we can integrate our devotion to our master, Yeshua, in a way that's perfectly at home within the native soil of Judaism. Well, okay, back to the beginning. What's that? The story with the Maxwell House Coffee Haggadah? Well, here's how it goes. In the early 20th century, many American Jews were not so sure about drinking coffee during Passover. They would switch to tea. And that's because on Passover, Ashkenazi Jews abstain from kitnios. It's a category that includes legumes. But while coffee is commonly referred to as a bean, it's actually not a bean. It's not a legume at all. And so there's really no reason to forbid coffee on Passover. So an entrepreneur, a marketer named Joseph Jacobs, captured the Jewish market on behalf of Maxwell House by securing kosher certification for the coffee. And he also ran a promotion where if you bought a can of their coffee, you would get a free Passover Haggadah, and you know, it's a standard Haggadah with the traditional text and with Maxwell House coffee branding. And in the process, then, not only did Joseph Jacobs lay claim to the Jewish market, but he also ended up publishing and distributing one of the most widely used Haggadahs in America. And in the promotion that Joseph Jacobs started 93 years ago continues to this day. It's the longest running advertisement promotion in history. Well, anyway, that's the story of the Maxwell House Haggadah, and that's the story of night and day. So I encourage you to really look deeper into the Siddur and next year in Jerusalem. Take on my yoke and learn from me and find rest for your soul.